Welcome to Holden Village. In the Fireside Room, today's speaker is Paul Olson, and he will be doing a session entitled African American Literature, A Necessary View. So, let's listen in on Paul.
We've just been talking about Norwegian jokes, and we introduced this with Norwegian stories and jokes. And how is it different, do you think, that we can tell a Norwegian joke here comfortably and laugh, but if anybody brought up that's an ethnic joke. And if anybody brought up a joke about African Americans, first of all, you'd be completely out of taste, and we wouldn't laugh. Why do you suppose that is?
None of us is African American.
Well, and your name is Dick?
David.
David, I'm sorry. You live right next to me, and I didn't. Yeah, I saw our new addition to the house in the back there too. I went back there to hang up some clothes. we're the only Norwegians here, and yet you laughed. And I find, as somebody who teaches African American literature, even around black students that I know very well, and black colleagues that I know very well, I wouldn't think of telling a joke like that. And when they do, I mean, just if I'm the only white guy among six black people, and they tell a black joke, I find it hard to laugh. And do you have a sense of why that might be? We didn't hesitate, Norwegian or not, to laugh at the Norwegian.
No, because if you're in a different, like I had a sister-in-law who was Polish, and she was always telling, I'm Scots. And anyway, she would always tell about her, she's a Polak, you know. So they tell Polak jokes. When Helen was around, they'd switch it from Polak to Norwegian or whatever. It's the same type of thing. But no, I don't know why we were.
Well, I sure couldn't have said, did you hear about the black community in Louisiana that had a library? And I mean, I couldn't have said that.
Because it's too much treatment.
Well, there's something to that, isn't there? That's an interesting observation. There's truth and the truth comes out of, I'm looking for a word, I think. What?
It was painful truth.
Yeah, for sure. Painful truths.
And the suffering.
Exactly. Norwegians, though they came to this country in the 19th century, and some in the 19th century, and settle and take away, you know, they can get into that too, take away land and so on. There's suffering there. There is not oppression, is there?
No.
And there's not institutionalized, organized, deliberate, structured, all coming under the word institutionalized, oppression, as there is for in American tradition for blacks. And that all comes down to one institution, slavery. But slavery is very complicated, as you know. Well, one of the things that I thought I would share with you today, and we can share back and forth our responses to some of this, is the perspective that we bring to the African-American, everybody in this room is white, that we bring to the African-American experience. And when we start out with Norwegian jokes, and we can laugh at them, and we can laugh because we just kind of go on our way. And I am Norwegian, and that's okay with me to be Norwegian. I haven't been oppressed, neither have my ancestors. And I can just go on with my life without having to reflect or having to be an inheritor of anything that's been oppressive. Whereas the black man or woman that would tell the same story, put it in a different, in a black ethnic, in a black race mode, and then all of a sudden it becomes an oppressive story too. Well, what do we do with that? It seems as though in American history, throughout its hundreds of years, as well as through our current lives, just all of us in this room, we either ignore that, or we don't know a thing about it, so we just go on with our blinders, as Andre Brink says in that wonderful book, A Dry White Season, which, by the way, is in the bookstore. It's a story about oppression in South Africa. This is a white man talking about apartheid in South Africa, and he said, I went into a black township that he'd never been in before. He'd lived in South Africa for 40 years, and he'd never, ever seen a black township. And he called it, suddenly I was on the other side of the moon, the other side of the moon that I'd always heard about, but now there are people there. And that speaks well for all of us, I think, in our experiences with the American Black experience. We don't know what that experience is, and either we don't know or we know a little and we turn our backs on it. And I'm going to ask you for some experiences that you might have had, and I'll give you an idea of what I mean by those kind of experiences. My own academic experience, and sorry that you've heard this a couple times, is I had finished a master's degree in American literature. And I had an undergraduate degree in American history and American literature, and English and American literature. And now I have a master's degree. And I attended three different higher institutions of higher education. And they all told me that it was okay, now you with a master's degree in American literature, it's okay not to know one single African-American writer. Somebody said to me, as 2 weeks before commencement of the at the University of Oregon, have you read Richard Wright's Native Son? And my response was, well, who's Richard Wright? This was 1970. Either we don't know or we turn our backs. And for me, professionally and academically, institutionally, I had actually been forced to turn my back. You better know about Hawthorne and Hemingway and Melville and Keats and Shelley, and I'm getting into English literature too. You better know these guys, ladies, and that's what it was too, right? It's mostly men too. And you better know these guys, but we don't have to know. We'll just push them off to the side and it's okay, you get the point. Have you experienced anything like that either in your professional life, in any dimensions of your lives? Where it's the other side of the moon.
I never went to school in a school where there was a black child. Never. In all school. And I went in two or three different, in Detroit, Michigan, which now is solid black.
Yeah.
But I went to school there 2 years, and I first and second grade, I think. And in Plymouth, Michigan, and the rest of it. And then back to Lake Orion, Michigan, when I graduated from high school. But there was never a black child in school. And that's unusual anymore, you know.
Right, right. So that's a whole other world to you.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good illustration of that, where we it's the other side of the moon for you, too, as it was for Andre Brink's character.
I worked with them and had them work under me. In fact, I worked at the Nevada test site, and when they were doing the testing to get the guy on the moon, to get the rocket going, and they had to have so many blacks for every so many whites. And I was chosen to always have one because I got along so well with them. I had no problem with them at all.
Yeah. That's a good illustration. Anybody else have anything where...
I think just the way American history is taught and the perspective that's brought by white historians excludes anybody else's version of the story.
And right.
Until I became more aware that there were other cultures who had a different way of telling the story, I just assumed that's the way it was. Nobody ever suggested that there could be another way of looking at each, you know.
Yeah.
Historical event.
Yeah, very good. I can support that with an illustration. In my sophomore year in high school, my high school English teacher, or history teacher, I mean, said in an American history class, you know, slavery really wasn't so bad. And that's a perspective that this very good guy, an important role model in lots of people's lives, that's a perspective he gained through his education, through how he was taught history. And since then I've read several hundreds of slave narratives, and I can argue that there's not one single slave who would say slavery was not so bad. In fact, they would all say slavery was awful to a person. And we'll look at some of that today, too. So that's interesting. That's another dimension of that, that our history has been told through the eyes of, as one slave says, 'tis he who was looked on, or 'tis he who has endured, that can describe slavery, not he who has looked on. And we've been told a story from those who have looked on entirely.
remember I graduated as a history major from college 15 years ago. At that time, at least, the American history was starting to get the story told also from the black perspective. But as far as world history, it was still European.
Yep.
There's no third world. There's probably one elective or two you could take, but it wasn't required.
Yeah.
And then the seminary, the same way. Maybe a couple seminars or something, but it was a very much a European model.
Yep. That's interesting. In the seminary, that becomes then, it's the only theology, it's the only history, it's the only literature, and it comes down to a profound philosophical observation that we can see in literature over and over again. This is the way life is valued. This is what makes life important. And if you have a different look at that, I mean, one of the ways that we could institutionalize slavery, in some ways, I mean, it wasn't casual, but it was easily argued for, is that, well, they're savages, they're barbaric, they need to be made Christian, they're not as intelligent. There's all kinds of things that this Western civilization would look at and say, that's different, therefore, you know, different meant what?
Inferior.
Yeah. And so we go ahead and it's okay to enslave. And then throughout history, throughout American slave history, we see that those arguments get turned over on their head. And when one argument gets turned over, another one comes up. I mean, and maybe you've heard about some of the crazy arguments in pseudoscience called phrenology. They just kind of, well, you got so many bumps on your head, and therefore African Americans have, I don't remember if it's less or more, and it isn't even true, but they'd say, oh, you got more bumps, therefore you're less intelligent, and that has to do with this whole, so the scientific quotes around that, pseudoscientific argument. Well, then that gets debunked by some real science, and so they can't prove that. Well, then look what else comes up. Well, then there's economic theories, and then there are social theories, and then there are religious theories, and on it goes. Something to continually try to justify that, and in the end it turns out that it's irrational, as prejudice is, and it can't be justified. One of the crazy things, and we'll see it today too, that I've seen with the whole history of prejudice is that as we deal with it and we realize how irrational it is, we continue to stretch farther for more kind of crazy rationalizations. And an illustration I'll give you now is that applied in America too, but it's most explicitly spelled out in South African literature, where a black kid is arrested, and then, as you've read about, you know, oftentimes they're beaten to death in their jail cell, and this happens, and they take it, and the parent of this black kid, they go to court. And the court stands up with this elaborate system showing how, I mean, they've got a white jury, and they've got white Afrikaners who are in charge of the apartheid system and strongly believe in it, who are on the prosecution as well as the defense. I mean, there is no hope for this black family to get any justice. And the whole system unfolds, and at the end they say, innocent. The charges brought against the guys who beat the black kid in the jail. And you read that and you can't help but wonder, why don't they just say, yeah, we beat the hell out of them, and what are you going to do about it? They could do that. And in the end, in a sense, that's what they've done, except that they've put it under this charade of this false justice system. So what does that do? All these people, it seems to just all these white people, clinging to the system of apartheid, have been reinforced by this system that they have set up historically through theology, through literature, through history, through social sciences, through every dimension of every perspective of looking at this irrational prejudice. I've been justified again. See, we're innocent of this. And again we find it. That's why I've called it on the title on the kiosk, it's a necessary view. I think whether it's a Native American, and I'm not an expert on that, it's any kind of perspective that changes our historical Western perspective theologically, literally, historically, socially, is going to free us as well of myths that we've lived by, and it creates freedom in us to accept and love in ways that before I think we've been bound by the parameters that say this is the way you must live, and unless you do, your life is worthless.
We read that book published by the Harvard professor recently, The Bell Curve.
Yeah. It's a great modern example of more ways to somehow justify the prejudice that we've long lived with. That ultimately, no matter how many tests and rationalizations you read, it comes out that prejudice is irrational. But that doesn't make it any less oppressive or powerful or invasive individually and while it's socially. Well, another thing to set up this that I was going to ask you about is that you all know about the... what amendment is it that lets women vote in American society? I mean, why would you know? But it's the 22nd. And you know what the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments are? And why would you? The 13th Amendment abolished slavery. The 14th made slaves citizens, and the 15th allowed them to vote. And of course, we know that this takes place in the 1860s, and we know that they didn't get to vote until the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and that got a whole another look even in 1988, I mean, as late as that. So voting wasn't an automatic thing. And when the 16th Amendment comes in to let blacks vote, all the states pick up this, you know, the grandfather clause, that if your grandfather voted, you can vote. Well, of course, your grandfather didn't, because he was a slave. So you don't vote, and it continues down through the generations. Well, an interesting thing about that, and I say that about the 22nd Amendment that lets women vote, and the 13th, 14th, and 15th that give rights to black citizens too, is that in our Constitution, and this relates to what you said about the historical perspective and in seminary too, in our Constitution we have no amendment that lets white males vote. I really feel slighted.
Was it automatic?
That's the answer. That's assumed. We don't even have to make it an issue. But it's an issue. And if I were a woman, even today, I would make that an issue. That it's an issue, that it's in our Constitution, that you get to vote. And that we don't even have to think about that.
Why don't we bring that up and make all something?
Well, go to Tinker's session today on radical social change. I haven't seen that yet, but I'm sure going to go and see what happens there. But that's another illustration, I think, that fits the kind of perspective I'm going to try to bring to you in just in a second here. I'll get to that. But I do want to set it up. That brings us to this new vision, this new perspective that says maybe this isn't automatic, and that maybe every white male shouldn't have the right to vote, if, and you get the point. And we never thought about that. It's just automatic, and we had to think and fight and struggle and march and everything else to get women to vote. Well, that kind of automatic perspective, that we just make assumptions about the nature of life, we make assumptions about the nature of God, we make assumptions about the nature of the connectedness between humans and God, all kinds of assumptions are made. And I think the African-American perspective in literature brings us other perspectives that change that. And let me just read a couple of those to you. In your question, what is your name?
Laurel.
You said earlier, before some of you got here, we're talking about issues in African American, in racial conflict. And somebody said, well, America's kind of tired of that. And your comment was, wouldn't it be nice that everybody could afford to be tired of it? But if it's a part of your daily life, you don't have the choice, your language, to get tired of it. It's always there. Well, the choices or the lack of choices that confront this woman named Linda Brent in a book called Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl are really revealing, and it suggests to us something about the legacy of slavery that goes, of course, generations past the abolition of slavery. This book, it's called Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, written by, actually her name is Harriet Jacobs, but in the library and in the card catalog you'll find it under Linda Brent, she writes under a pseudonym. And until I had read this, I had read nothing written. I'd heard a couple of narratives in the writer's work project back in the 1920s of women talking about slavery, but to have something published, this is really kind of the first. Published way back in 1848 and then brought out again in 1979 and kind of made popular for African-American literature classes in about 1984. Slavery for a woman was different. And we never had that, those of us who studied this, studied slavery and studied African-American history, never had that perspective before too. So first we're brought up with this white perspective on slavery that makes my history teacher say, you know, slavery really wasn't so bad. Then we have the black American slave writing, He Who Endured, writing about slavery, and we find out that slavery was pretty awful. Then we have the black woman writing about slavery, and we still see another dimension of the complicated effects that create this incredible legacy that is still a part of us today, the legacy of slavery. The legacy that, if you know the great intellect W.E.B. Du Bois at the turn of the century said, the problem of America's 20th century will be the problem, guess what, of the color line. And how do we deal with our relationships with people of color? And he raises that question way back in 1905. Well, a couple of episodes to read to you from this incident in the life of a slave girl reveal to us, I think, this new perspective. In the first one, I'll set this up. She is a very attractive, light-skinned slave, and her slave and her owner is continually whispering in her ear kind of licentious stuff about sex. And Linda Brent is very faithful to her mother's teachings about the Christian faith and about typical traditional Christian morality. So these guys' whisperings in her ear are really offensive, and as well as frightening, because, you know, one thing, the power of that he has over her to do whatever he wants. I mean, he doesn't have to seduce her. He can rape her. But he, as it happens often, not to her, but happens in the black tradition. He doesn't want to do that. And so instead, he whispers these vile things and finally sets up a plan for her where he's going to build a house just off of the plan. He's married and has children. And his wife looks at Linda all the time with evil eyes and would like to kill her, and she's afraid that she will, because she knows what's going on between her husband and this slave. So he's going to build a little house for her about 100 yards away from the house down from the main house, down in the woods, where he will, quote, keep her. And he'll take good care of her, he says, but she will be his sex object, and she can't live with that, either because of his power, neither because of his power or because of her own morality. Well, her way out of this situation is that she has met a white, unmarried man who has showed interest in her. And she decides to have sex with him because if she can get pregnant, then this owner will not want her. And he's going to keep her as a slave, but he's going to stop harassing her sexually. So she has to stoop to breaking her own moral code. And what I'm trying to suggest to you is the incredible complications of this woman's life. And she is, by the way, 16 years old. The incredible complications in her life to kind of walk this web of morality and power and autonomy and all that goes on in slavery. Well, here's what she says about that scene when she's writing as an adult. It chanced that a white unmarried gentleman had obtained some knowledge of the circumstances in which I was placed. He knew my grandmother and often spoke to me in the street. He became interested in me. Of course, I saw where all this was tending. I knew the impassable gulf between us. But to be an object of interest to a man who is not married and who is not her master is agreeable to the pride and feelings of a slave, if her miserable situation has left her any pride or sentiment. There may be sophistry in all this, but the condition of a slave confuses all principles of morality. I made a headlong plunge. Pity me and pardon me, O virtuous reader. This is written in the 19th century, so there's some of this Victorian apology and a Victorian kind of morality or properness, I think we could call it, too. I made a headlong plunge. Pity me and pardon me, O virtuous reader. You never knew what it is to be a slave, to be entirely unprotected by law or custom, to have the laws reduce you to the condition of a chattel, entirely subject to the will of another. Chattel simply means property. You never exhausted your ingenuity in avoiding the snares and eluding the power of a hated tyrant. You never shuddered at the sound of his footsteps and trembled within hearing of his voice. I know I did wrong. And this is the moral, I mean, her own morality. Everybody with me? What she feels? Okay, and that's her confusion. No one can feel it more sensibly than I do. The painful and humiliating memory will haunt me to my dying day. Still, in looking back calmly on the events of my life, I feel that the slave woman ought not to be judged by the same standard as others. The months passed on. I had many unhappy hours. I secretly mourned over the sorrow I was bringing on my grandmother, who had so tried to shield me from harm. I knew that I was the greatest comfort of her old age, and that it was a source of pride to her that I had not degraded myself like most of the slaves. But now she's what? Unworthy. You will hear her explain this. Unworthy of her grandmother's love as soon as she finds out, I mean, she can't keep the secret forever, that she's pregnant. So this, the woman that matters most to her in her life, her grandmother, the woman that taught her her own moral system, her own moral code, she is now unworthy to even confront. I wanted to confess to her that I was no longer worthy of her love, but I could not utter the dreaded words. Then Dr. Flint, that's her owner, came and told me the cottage was completed, and he ordered me to go to it. I told him I would never enter it. He said, "I have heard enough of such talk as that. You shall go if you are carried by force, and you shall remain there." I replied, "I will never go there. In a few months, I shall be a mother." He stood and looked at me in dumb amazement and left the house without a word. I thought I should be happy in my triumph over him, but now that the truth was out and my relatives would hear of it, I felt wretched. Humble as were their circumstances, they had pride in my good character. Now, how could I look them in the face? My self-respect was gone. I had resolved that I would be virtuous, though I was a slave. I had said, "Let the storm beat, I will brave it till I die." But now, how humiliated I felt. My grandmother exclaimed, "Oh, Linda, has it come to this? I had rather see you dead than to see you as you are now. You are a disgrace to your dead mother." She tore from my fingers my mother's wedding ring and her silver thimble. "Go away," she exclaimed, "and never come to my house again." My mind was full of horrid thoughts. I prayed to die. But the prayer was not answered. At last, with great effort, I roused myself and walked some distance further to the house of a woman who had been a friend of my mother. When I told her why I was there, she spoke soothingly to me, but I could not be comforted. I thought that somehow I could bear my shame if only I could be reconciled to my grandmother. I longed to open my heart to her. I thought if she could know the real state of the case and all that I had been bearing for years, and she's talking about the vile approaches of her owner. But she never told her grandmother about this because she couldn't. That maybe then my grandmother would perhaps judge me less harshly. My friend advised me to send for her. I did. But days of agonizing suspense passed before she came. Had she utterly forsaken me? No, she came at last. I knelt before her and told her things that had poisoned my life, how long I had been persecuted, that I saw no way of escape, and in an hour of extremity, I had become desperate. She listened in silence. I told her I would bear anything and do anything, and if in time I had hopes of obtaining her forgiveness. I begged of her to pity me for my dead mother's sake, and she did pity me. She did not say, "I forgive you," but she looked at me lovingly with her with her eyes full of tears. She laid her old hand gently on my head and murmured, "Poor child, poor child." End of the scene. Grandmother understands what slavery does. And that she says she never forgave her, it isn't probably even an issue. Because grandmother understands. And just, you've been through this. And you get the whole scene with this, "Poor child. Poor child," summarizing and symbolizing the whole experience that was an incident in the life of a slave girl. Frederick Douglass, in his narrative, and this is a slave narrative written in 1845, I should suggest, I'll just step aside for a second. There's a book called American Negro Slavery, and it was kind of the history book of Americans. I mean, it's called American Negro Slavery, written in 1920. I don't know how much effect that had on people who majored in history, as you and I did, but I know that after 529 pages of studying American Negro slavery, his conclusion was that you could travel the South as far as I did, far down past the Shenandoah and not come upon a slave that's unhappy. That was his conclusion. And then he went on in his last paragraph of his book to say, and to find out the truth about slavery, you have to go to courthouse records and birth records. You can't just ask plantation owners and so on. I read this book and had these conclusions that were so absurd. And then he makes these great claims about authentic historical research. And so I studied then his footnotes, and out of, you know, hundreds and hundreds of footnotes, not one of them referred to a black writer or a black voice of any kind. So no wonder he concludes, you know, so he makes this valid, quotes around valid, this valid historical conclusion that slavery wasn't so bad, that my history teacher then tells me 40 years later in the 1960s, slavery wasn't so bad. What effect did his book have on the whole process of studying history? Well, Linda Brent reverses that look. Frederick Douglass reverses that look. And just a quick episode in Douglass's life that suggests more. I mean, we've all read about if we saw Roots, and we know about the beatings, and we know about the physical horrors of slavery. But what these books do are suggest the incredible complex emotional, psychological, and it matters to us, theological implications of slavery. I was now about 12 years old, and the thought of being a slave for life began to bear heavily upon my heart. Just about this time, I got hold of a book entitled The Columbian Orator. Every opportunity I got, I used to read this book. Among much of other interesting matter, I found that the dialogue represented the conversation which took place between them when the slave was retaken for the third time. It's talking about a slave and a master. In the same book, I met with one of Sheridan's mighty speeches on and behalf of Catholic emancipation. These were choice documents to me. I read them over and over again with unabated interest. American Negro slavers said that the slaves are happy. They're content. His word even toward the end was, they're happy sambos. That he could get away with it. I brought a book along, if anybody wants to see it, I don't have it here today, but I brought it to Holden, a science book, pseudoscience for sure, this thick, by an R.W. Schoenfield, a medical doctor, going through all kinds of quasi-medical studies to suggest why we can't have any kind of integration, and in fact, we have a right to destroy blacks. I mean, this was a book that was in our Augustana library, and the librarian never put it out. And she showed it to me one day, and I said, I think this is one time probably when censorship is okay. I'll take it home with me. So, I don't know. I don't agree with censorship anyway, but I guess that one, I didn't want some freshman in college thinking that that was what our library thought. Well, he's read this story now in the Columbian Orator about freedom. The moral which I gained from the dialogue was the power of truth over the conscience of even a slaveholder. What I got from Sheridan was a bold denunciation of slavery and a powerful vindication of human rights. The more I read, the more I was led to abhor and detest my enslavers. There are two, and we'll see it, there are two powerful prongs of anti-slavery, and it's more complicated than that, but I'm oversimplifying, two powerful prongs of anti-slavery thought going through the slave's mind. One is the natural inclination to be free. And the other is, and it's the process of why the whites don't want to educate the blacks, because with education they understand freedom more, and that's the other prong. They learn it through all different kinds of experiences, and also in Douglass's case through reading, the nature of freedom too, and that slavery isn't the way that human beings were meant to live. Well, so he knew that anyway, intuitively. I mean, that seems to be one of the grace gifts that we have, and that slaves would argue for. Again, they don't have to have education to know that this is wrong. But the more I read, the more I was led to abhor and detest my enslavers. I'm skipping some more. As I read and contemplated the subject, behold, that very discontentment which Master Hugh had predicted would follow my learning to read, that's why they didn't want him to, had already come to torment and sting my soul to unutterable anguish. As I writhed under it, I would at times feel that learning to read had been a curse rather than a blessing. It had given me a view of my wretched condition without the remedy. It opened my eyes to the horrible pit, but to no ladder upon which to get out. It's clear slavery is an evil. A century later, Lorraine Hansberry writes a wonderful and a powerful play called The Drinking Gourd. And here's a very short scene from that. Sarah and Hannibal are two young slaves, and Hannibal is decided to escape to the north. And he meets Sarah out in the woods. She doesn't know he's going to leave, but he knows that he can't live under freedom, under slavery anymore, and that he has to have freedom. And in this very, very simple dialogue between Sarah and Hannibal, 100 years after slavery, written by that wonderful writer Lorraine Hansberry, she wrote Raisin in the Sun, if you've seen that or read that. It's been on television a lot. 100 years later, this young woman, this young playwright, understands the intuitive powers that are there by grace that suggest humans are meant to live free. Hannibal! Hannibal! And Hannibal is singing as he walks into the woods. And when she come to me, it were the moonrise. And when she touched my hand, it were the true stars falling. Singing to his girl. Hannibal, stop that singing. What you always running off for all the time? You're going to catch yourself another whipping, boy. But don't run off all the time. Oh, Hannibal. Oh, Hannibal. Oh, Hannibal. You say that so cute, Sarah. What you got there, Hannibal? Hannibal, master find you stole that Bible, you be in trouble bad. Me and you was born in trouble with the master, Sarah. Well, what do you think the Lord think of somebody who would steal the holy book itself? What do you think I would do with the Bible, Sarah? Sarah, I can read it. I can read, Sarah. Listen. The Book of Jeremiah. Hannibal. You can't make them marks out for real. You done memorized them from a prayer meeting. No, Sarah. Listen. And I said, oh, that I had wings like a dove, then would I fly away and be at rest. I can, Sarah. I can read. That's where you go all the time. Somebody been learning you. Learning you. Don't you know what they do to you if they finds out? Ain't nobody gonna find out. And don't you worry, little Sarah. Hey, look at here. What? Look at that big old fat star shining away up yonder there. Shh, Hannibal, shh. 1, 2, 3, 4, they mix up the dipper. Yep, that's the big dipper. Sarah, the old drinking gourd herself, pointing straight to the North Star. Sure is bright tonight. Sure would make good traveling light tonight. Stop it! Trees on this plantation got more ears than they got leaves. I don't care. Up there, just pointing away. Due north. Oh, Hannibal, you're just like your brother, boy. You're just like him. And Hannibal sings, for the old man is a-waiting for to carry you to freedom if you follow the drinking gourd. You look like him, you talk like him, and God knows you sure think like him. In time, I reckon, Hannibal, you're going to be gone like him. You think Isaiah got all the way to Canada, Sarah? Sure, I bet he did. I bet you old Isaiah's up there and he got himself a job and is living fine. I bet you that. I bet he works in a lumber yard or something and got himself a wife and maybe even a house and... If you mean if he's alive, Hannibal. Oh, he's alive all right. He's alive and he's free. I met him here that night to bring the food and an extra pair of shoes. He was standing right over there, with the moonlight streaming down on him, and he was breathing hard. Lord, that boy was breathing so as you could almost hear him on the other side of the woods. And he didn't say nothing to me, nothing at all. I just hand him the parcel, and he put it in his shirt, and he give me a kind of push on the shoulder. Here. And then he turned and lit out through them woods like lightning. He was bound out of this place. Hannibal, you aim to go too, don't you? Hannibal, how you know it's so much better to run off, even if you make it? How you know what's up there? What's it going to be like to go wandering around by yourself in this world? the greatest line in the play. I don't know, Sarah. I just know what it is to be a slave. We're all slaves, Hannibal. But there's some ain't got it so bad, who knows how to bend a little. Then let 'em bend! Me, I am the only kind of slave I could stand to be, a bad one. Every day that come, an hour that pass, that I got sense to make a half a step do for a whole, I do. Every day I can pretend sickness instead of health, to be stupid instead of smart, lazy instead of quick, I aims to do it. And the more pain it give master, and the more it cost him, the more Hannibal is going to be a man. Where would you go? Just north, that's all I know. Try to find Isaiah, maybe. How I know what I do. But there's people up there that helps runaways. You mean them abolitionists? I heard Master Sweet say once that they catches runaways and make soap out of them. That slave owner talk, Sarah. Whatever you hear Master say about slavery, you always believe the opposite. Way I look at it, every slave ought to run off before he die. Oh, Hannibal, I couldn't go. I'm too delicate. My breath wouldn't hold out from here to the river. Oh, Sarah, not you, scarified as you is. But don't you worry. I'll come back. I'll come back and buy you. Mama, too, if she's still living. I surely do that thing. Well, what do you make of that scene? What's in there in the characters? And fear? What?
A lot of hate.
Hate? I do it. Every time I can make a half step do for a whole. Yep.
Rebellion.
In The Incidents of the Life of a Slave Girl, Linda Brent says, dear reader, in that Victorian way, dear reader, have you ever hated? I hope not, because it destroys your soul. And it's part of this, part of the legacy of slavery. Hate to fear. One of the great theological things that I believe that black writers understand, I mean, they understand not unconsciously either. They understand it consciously. I mean, it's the liberation of theology. I mean, it's liberation theology. It might be the liberation of theology too. It is this liberation theology that Hannibal knows that the wilderness experience, to wander out there without certainty, without the absolutes, and I don't know where I'm going. Oh, I couldn't do it. I'm too frail. No, you couldn't go. I mean, it's Moses' experience with the people in the Exodus, right? I've read it and countered it, in fact, because it's so astonishing to me. Three times the people of the Hebrews say to Moses, we'd be better off in Egypt to live under the, you know, in slavery than to wander in, there's that metaphorical phrase now, than to wander in the wilderness. And the writer, the slaves understood the incredible gesture it is to live in the wilderness with all the uncertainty. As opposed to, but I know what it is, there's Hannibal. I just know what it is to be a slave.
And she still didn't know what it was fully to be a slave. Is she still trusting the master?
Yeah.
Is still believing by him? And he said, no, you got to believe the opposite.
Yep. It's a great point. Yes. And earlier she said, some of us don't have it so bad.
Yeah.
All slaves, says Hannibal.
Yeah.
Yep.
I think she just likes the security. She knows what it is to be a slave. She just, it's something that's known, and there's some security
sure.
with that, no matter how bad it is.
Sure. And that's a concept. Tomorrow I'm going to do something with Holocaust literature. That same kind of thinking is a part of the Jews. I'm generalizing now. There are lots of people who, you know, ran to the forests and rebelled, of course, but that led to the slaughter, walked to the slaughter of the of the gas chambers, had something to do with the certainty of their hope and the certainty of their belief that this is so awful it's impossible. And that they couldn't believe it. So they walked, you know, people ask them, well, how did you just walk to the slaughter? What's the matter with you? Why didn't you rebel? It has something to do with this profound connection to certainty and and I'm not going to give up my hope, and I'm certain that this is impossible, and I'm certain that this could not possibly happen in the 20th century. I mean, and it's more complicated than that. But it's another manifestation of this struggle against the certainty and the security, as you said, of what we know versus the wilderness experience of what we don't know.
And what happens to the society that has an aftermath, the same way as the South African court, where the white system, they do all this justice.
Exactly.
And it's all charade, and finally you can't believe justice. You can't believe the system.
That's right.
Totally lie. But so it's, you have to believe the exact opposite
to
be saved, I guess.
Yeah, that's really good. And there you just touch on the profound theological implications that are here in this, that what can we believe? And it has to do with religious parameters that are set up and established. And this, and we know about that from all kinds of discussions in our national church and the Presbyterian church and the Lutheran church, all the mainline churches, the absolutes that have been established for sexuality, the absolutes that have been for gender, equity or non-equity, on and on it goes with absolutes. These are ways we must live, and we're going to cling to these rather than take a step in the wilderness. We would rather, most of us, like the Hebrews with Moses, frankly, I'd rather be a slave. This is too tough. Here's why, and I'll end with, I'll tell you one story and just read the other. This is an episode in a wonderful novel called Not Without Laughter by Langston Hughes. He's more famous really for his poetry in the Harlem Renaissance time. There are three episodes, one episode and then kind of episode two is A and B parts to it, okay? The first episode that I'm not going to read is about the hero of the story, the protagonist of the story is a little boy about 10 years old, and he goes to his fifth grade class where it's the first time in his life he's been in an integrated school, and the teacher stands up and calls all the white kids by name and has them sit down, and then says, all right, you four, pointing to the four black kids, and doesn't mention their name, sit in the back row there. That's all she says to him. And he walks to the back row just completely deflated. They've gone alphabetically through the white kids and thrown the four black kids at the end. And one of the points of the illustration in the novel is to deal with, Sandy is the name of this kid. The pain he has to deal with will be this kind of rejection and this kind of isolation that he has. But it's also to point out to us that here's an adult white male that has bought into the system of, I'm going to call it, apartheid that America practiced for many, many years. It's the Jim Crow segregation, that's the American phrase given to it, that they practice. Okay, so she has bought into that. She's knowledgeable, and she's 30, she's an adult anyway. She's somewhere up there, 30, 40 years old. Well, we ask the question, should she know better? Well, I don't know. We like to think so. Then another scene happens where Sandy and his one white friend and one black friend, the three of them have been cutting coupons out of the newspapers to go to a carnival in the local town, Stanton, Kansas. And they've been cutting coupons, and it builds up for several pages how excited they are about this. And they walk a long ways, and I'll skip that because my time is just about up. And they get to the park. And they got on shine shoes and their best dresses, even though it's a carnival, because it's just an exciting thing. It's a long rock to the park. I'm going to ride on that first, said Sandy. And again, and over through paragraphs, they build up the anticipation of the excitement, anticipation and excitement of the kids. The band was playing gaily inside. They were almost to the entrance now. There were two boys in front of them. Willie Mae, Sandy's little friend, she's black, held out her black little hand, clutching the coupons. They moved forward. The man looked down. Sorry, he said. This party's for white kids. And after pages and for these kids weeks of buildup, we've got a guy standing at the gate, not unlike his Sandy's teacher earlier in the school year, saying, sit in the back, saying, sorry kids, this party is for white kids. He doesn't say it unkindly. He doesn't kick him in the back and say, get out of here, you, and give some racial slur. He says, sorry, I'm sorry. This adult that has bought into the absolutes of this system that somehow has evolved unconsciously and deliberately as well, unconsciously through slavery and past slavery. And here we are with a legacy of slavery where a guy says, I'm sorry. Now we know as adults, he's got some options. go on in there. I'll lose my job, but you just go in there and have a good time, because this is wrong. Or, you know, he's kind of sneak in the back. Or, I mean, he could do anything. He could just quit his job. I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to guard the gate. But instead, he follows the status quo. Well, the end of the episode is, Sandy is distraught, walks off with his little friend Willie Mae, and they come up to their little white friend Earl, and here's a powerful scene. "What's the matter, Sandy? Ain't you going in?" Earl demanded, looking at his friend's worried face. "Did Willie Mae hurt her foot?" "No," said Sandy. "We just ain't going in." "Here, Earl, you can have my coupons. If you have extra ones, the paper says you can get more lemonade. So you take them." The white boy, puzzled, accepted the offered coupons, stood dumbly, confused for a moment, wondering what to say to his brown friend, and then went on into the park. The question, I've read that 100 times to myself out loud and to myself, is, Earl is 10. He doesn't understand racism, and he doesn't understand bigotry, and he doesn't understand the historical forces of slavery. What about the guy at the gate, and what about the teacher? And the legacy of slavery that connects all of this, the vision that was necessary for all of us. At what point are we responsible? The teacher didn't know at 35. We excuse the kid, don't we? How does he know? He takes his coupons, you're not going in, huh? I mean, say anything, explain to him. But at what point? And it's the question that's begged again and again and again by the black, by the Native American, by any perspective that comes from the oppressed voice that suggests there's another way to look at life. And there's a responsible way to consider how human beings interact. And now I'm going to sound like an English teacher and suggest that all literature teaches us that. Again and again and again, that there's a responsible, sensitive way to act toward our fellow human beings. But at what point are we expected, are we responsible, are we accountable to know and to be conscious of the goodness that can be within us and the evil that's struggling at us from all these forces? By the way, the session is over. A wonderful end to that episode is they go back home and Sandy tells his grandmother, who raises him, about this, and his grandmother says, "Well, you know, I wrote in my margin the first time I read it, Grandma could go to the school superintendent, could go to the mayor, could go to the Civil Rights Commission, could file a lawsuit, could do all kinds of things. Instead, she gets out a watermelon and says, we're going to have our own party." And what it does is it affirms those kids' existence and the meaningfulness of their life apart from any kind of broader social context. I don't care what they say. I mean, Grandma, she doesn't say this, but the implication is, I'm not going to go off and protest. I have to be a part of your system. She has said to him, your system is sick and it's wrong, and Sandy, let's have a party anyway because we're worthwhile and we are grace-filled people. I mean, to lose theological terms. That's a wonderful end of that scene. Anyway, thanks.
If you have a chance, a little boy asked me to come and watch a movie with him at his grandmother's, and it was Angels in the Outfield. And I almost didn't go, and then I thought, well, I'll drive out. I knew I'd be getting home late, and so on. I was glad, because he was sitting right there with the thing on the TV and ready to go. And it was really something, because in it there are 3 children in an orphanage. I would say it's an orphanage. A woman is taking care of a
foster home.
A foster home of some sort. And 2 of them are black, and 1 is white. And the crux of the whole thing is the white boy believes in angels. And he sees these angels, and of course they get in the ball field, yep, and they do all these things. But the manager of the team that becomes a winner because of the angels is black. And one of the boys is put into a home. One of the old black boys, and these other 2 are left. But then they find out that they're going to close this home down. The woman tells them if they come back, but she's there. Oh, the black boy and the white boy are just like this. And then she says, but I've got good news for you. You're going to have a home. And it's the black coach that adopts both of them. It was really great.
Yeah, I have seen it. It's a wonderful story. Yeah. Anybody have anything you want to throw out?
Well, I do.
It's time to go, so.
I know. I'm a kindergarten teacher, and I teach in a racially mixed school. It's a pretty good balance between white, Asian, and African-American kids. And children are very, you know, they don't distinguish or discriminate or have the prejudices that society seems to teach all of us, even if we are trying to resist it. And so when January comes and we're supposed to say something about Martin Luther King Day and bring up prejudice and discrimination and things, the kids always are so shocked. And there's part of me that says, I am introducing ideas that they don't have, you know, and there's something wrong with this, and yet, you know, it's important, I think, to prepare them, because sooner or later they're going to come up against it. Better that they be forewarned that ideas like this exist, and so they can have thought about it and not just accept it. But I always feel like I'm just doing a disservice to these kids, because they just look like this can't be. It's not possible that one should value one skin color over another.
There's a wonderful spelling out of that journey by an English poet named William Blake, and it's called, for him, The Journey from Innocence to Experience. And you just taking your kids on that journey. Mm-hmm. But for Blake, it doesn't stop there. Most of us die, says Blake, in that stage of experience. Innocent kids think, well, what's prejudice? Experience teaches them what it is. And Blake's final stage, higher innocence, is that they can, and you without your step, your intervening step, they don't get to higher innocence. They die in that stage of, when they're taught about, well, you know, blacks are inferior, you know, blacks are this and this, and they're going to buy it. Mm-hmm. But because you, does that make sense? I mean, I'm just celebrating your going on that journey with them, because they'll get to the higher innocence that, in spite of the stuff that society has done, they're going to have this, they're going to have innocence now, but it's not innocence out of ignorance. It's innocence out of all the best things. For Blake, it's out of love and sensitivity. And it's neat stuff. So nice going. Whatever that's worth to you.
Thanks. Never.
Little kids don't see color.
No. I remember a woman that was raised in South Africa. She talked about that for some reason they let the kids play together. So she played with the kid of the maid until she was 6 or 7. And then she remembered her 7th birthday. Her mother, she tried to play with her and slapped her because she can't social. Mm-hmm. But then she always remembered what it was like before.
Mm-hmm. What was that in? Where is it?
In South Africa.
Oh.
She was allowed to play with the maid's child until 6 or 7, whatever it was. But even after all those years, she could remember what it was like to play with that child before.
You know, we say that kids don't see color, but that's only true if you're the majority culture. We adopted an African-American child, and she always saw color. Yep. She always noticed when there was an African-American family at the zoo or whatever. She'd relate to them. So, you know, it's only if you're the majority culture you might not see or notice.
You're right. We make incredible assumptions about life. Just I have a good friend, a close friend who's black. Situation of walking in to apply for a loan for my house. It never dawned on me. They'd even ask me other, what do you do? What's your salary? You know, the stuff you got to go through. And I fill it out and get it. And I walk out there and I got whatever I need, loan. And he's got the same kind of, he teaches too, profession. He's got more money than I do. And boy, he had to go through a whole, in 1990, a whole lot more stuff than I do. If you're, yeah. And we just make assumptions daily. He's married to a white woman. When his wife is with him, when his wife is not with him, he was a professional football player. He is followed around nicely, but he goes into a Kmart store. Oh, can I help you? Mm-hmm. Right away. He goes in with his wife. Nobody meets him at the gate, you know. Hmm. He's been stopped by the cops twice for driving in his, he lives in a pretty nice neighborhood, and he just comes up in his normal Chevy Suburban, and you know, that's a nice car. They just stop. What are you doing here? I live up here, just a couple blocks off, sir. Oh, okay. I mean, they don't harass him, except that's harassment.
Yes, that is. Mm-hmm.